Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted,
the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 177 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. In this week's episode, we will be discussing, we're starting part five in Voyager. The part five is entitled, You Can't Go Home Again. And we'll be starting that part off with chapter 18 entitled Roots. So, a lot of comments. This is going to be likely a decently long episode because we've got two chapters and a lot of comments. We begin chapter 18. We are told it is September of 1968. I was negative 10.
Oh, you were negative. Anne S. writes, does Claire really have any? This is in regards to the title. 20 years in one house doesn't seem to have been enough, and not even really to root her in a country.
She has roots. They're just back in 1700 Scotland.
I was going to say, and we're going to get to that because I have some questions about the title too. Some, do you think the title is, I hope this doesn't sound awful. Do you think the title is a double play on the fact that Joseph is African American? and that he represents in a fashion her roots in the U.S., or at least in medical school. Her life in the U.S. is tied up with Frank, Bree, and Joseph. Those are the three things. And Frank is gone. Bree is, for all intents and purposes, no longer hers. I mean, it's her daughter, but she's already planning on potentially going away. And she only came back besides to wind things up, potentially, and to get some guidance or some... To chat with a trusted friend. So I think those are her roots. So one of the roots of her life, if not America, the home, was Frank. He's gone. That root is gone. Bree is a root. Roger is becoming a root, maybe, but Joseph is a root. You see what I'm saying? I mean, there's the people that are the roots, the people, the ties. And then I immediately thought of the 1970s TV show.
They just remade it, by the way.
They did. Oh, I have to see it.
They did. And can we call him Joe, please? Because you're freaking me out when you call him Joseph. I'm like, who is Joseph? And I know that they introduced him as Joseph, but she calls him Joe.
Joe. Yeah, that's true.
And also this time of year when you say Joseph, I'm thinking mangers,
Married virgins,
virgin births, mangers. Okay. Yeah.
So Lisa T writes, the more I read, the more I saw how parallel Jamie and Claire's lives are. First, in terms of raising their children, in terms of Jamie's 7 years in a cave, Claire's 7 years before she went to medical school, and now in terms of their friendships. We have seen Jamie and John's complicated friendships. In some sense, they are both outlanders. Jamie because he is a prisoner, and John because he is gay at a time when that was a punishable offense. Now we meet Claire's friend, Dr. Joe Abernathy. We meet him in her reminiscing of her time and her life in Boston and her friendship with Joe. So she's on an airplane to New York. She's not a plane sleeper. She has a romance novel with her, but her attention goes back to Roger and Bree. And to what lay ahead in Boston.
I wonder if her not being a plane sleeper has anything to do with the time she fell asleep in a car.
Maybe almost
in a car accident, and then she woke up with the car rolling over.
Very potentially, and also maybe because if she fell asleep, I mean, she could dream, don't get me wrong, but if she fell asleep, we couldn't see. I mean, I guess you could do the same thing. I think it's a little more meaningful if she's awake and actively thinking about this stuff rather than in dreams where you really don't have control necessarily. Mm-hmm. Joe B. writes, you can't go home again. The place may have changed. It may not have. But you definitely have. And Claire has not been home in 20 years. Of course, because we know that Jamie is Claire's home and vice versa. Joe B. continues, Claire's flying back to Boston and to the reality of her choices. Her practicality is a coping strategy, reflecting on the house, the bills, the hospital, and Joe. In the overwhelm of what if... not finding answers at several thousand feet, She looks for distraction in her romance novel, but doesn't find it because she doesn't feel like she needs to. She's not really in the mood to read it. Okay, so she's unsure of what did actually await her. She had exhausted her vacation. She had lots of stuff to do around the house for the property. She wanted to see friends, etc. And she planned to see Joe Abernathy, whom she had met in medical school. She specifically wants to speak with him before she makes any final, quote, and irrevocable, unquote, decision. And we find out she owes her taste for romance novels to him. Both of them stood out in medical school, Diana tells us. She is the only woman and he as the only black intern. They were thus drawn to each other. But during their internship, they were both too wary to act upon this bond, whatever it was. It wasn't until near the end of their internship that she would have actually called them friends. Claire had finished her first unassisted surgery and wanted to stick around until her patient woke up. She showered and changed and went to the doctor's lounge. Joe was there. She chooses a paperback without its cover. It was titled The Impetuous Pirate. She randomly opens the book and it falls open to page 42. And I first thought of, wasn't 42 the answer to every question as per The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy?
Yes.
I make sure I didn't transpose the numbers. So I checked and yes, it was 42. So this, of course, means also because it fell open to the page, likely that it was a popular page.
Dude.
Can
we all remember back to the time? And he makes a mention of it later that the really good ones don't have covers. And
well, this one must have been good.
Right. Which just makes me think of all of the times that I was on the subway reading naughty fiction.
And you didn't tear your covers off?
And I never tore my covers off. I think that at times I contemplated making a book cover, like, you know, I was back in high school.
Yeah.
With like a paper bag. But I never actually did it. But I'm trying to.
I have a hard time defacing books. I would have covered it. I agree. Or put it in something. Like if it was small enough, put it within a magazine or I don't know. But yeah, I would have covered it probably.
But you know, ebooks have taken all the joy out of that.
Well, the need.
That too.
Claire is entertained, if not impressed, by this passage, and the scoff she makes gets Joe's attention. Now, Summer, am I the only one who thinks we see a glimpse into Diana's head while she's narrating Claire's reading of this romance novel?
With her feelings about
her reactions.
Kind of. Everything she writes gives us a glimpse inside of her head. True. So
even BJR, scary, scary. So she lets out, she was reading further, and she lets out a whoop and drops the book. And Joe, she sees, is grinning at her widely. He quotes the book to her and shows her another entertaining page, page 73.
I'm not going to lie. Whatever page she was already on was enough for me because I don't know that I could have seriously read that book. Maybe he just had to do with the, I don't know, but it's right up there with Waterweed for me.
Oh, gosh.
Like teasing her membranes. I'm like, bleh. It just sounds so gross.
It's been a long time since we discussed Waterweed. Not discussed, but had that.
And I feel like when you have romance novels like that, that use that type of language, they take all the sexy out of the sex. I'm like, because, I mean, if some dude, I mean, granted, no one was saying that out loud. But if that was the subtext going on in my head, it would be so unsexy.
And so, yes. And so, yes, Joe has read it.
Can you imagine it? Your first time in your head, your brain going, oh my God, he's teasing my membranes. He's teasing my membranes. It's going to happen.
Summer.
So not sexy.
Oh my goodness. There's so much I could say, but I can't.
You want to tell me about your membranes?
Summer, no. That's gross. No, exactly. I don't mean that. I mean examples along the lines of what you said, but I can't talk as freely like that as you can.
Okay.
Which makes it, I know, more, as you said, entertaining for others when I try. Mm. So yes, Joe has read it. Come to find out, there are a number of romance novels there in the doctor's lounge, and she's surprised that he reads them. He says that he spends so much time with his, quote, elbows in people's guts that he wants something mindless. And he calls her Lady Jane. He explains that the nickname was started actually by another intern, but it was her accent. Like she just drank tea with Queen that made them call her that. It's kept the guys around her from being as sexist, I presume, as they may have been. Well-behaved, maybe? And Joe continues, quote, "You've got something else, though. You have a way of talking like you expect to get your way. And if you don't, you'll know the reason why." Unquote. Diana describes Joe as having a gold tooth, visible when he smiles. Now, is that important?
That he has a gold tooth when he smiles?
Well, not when he smiles, but that he has a gold tooth. We don't know.
I don't think in that era, and I could be totally wrong because I was negative 10. I don't know that in that era if gold tooth were a fashion statement like they were in like the 80s and 90s.
Oh, I wasn't thinking that. I was thinking something else. Okay, never mind. We find out that Joe
I'm assuming it means that he didn't have good dentistry at some point.
Well, I mean, or didn't have what he had, but at least he had dental care at another point.
Exchanging doctoring for dentistry.
Oh, summer. Okay, this has gone off. So we find out that Joe used to entertain his mother by using the voice of Walter Cronkite. And Claire and Joe compare coming out stories. When he told his mom he wanted to be a doctor, and when she had told Frank. And they discuss how the others reacted or treated them when they found out they're going to school and becoming doctors. For Claire, it's more along the lines of, "Why aren't you home minding your husband and child?" Whereas for Joe, it's, "Why aren't you cleaning the toilets like God made you to?" I mean... Holy cannoli. That's again, makes me think of Roots. See why it's in my brain? Diana writes that Claire's patient woke up and she left. Quote, "But the friendship begun on page 42 had flourished, and Joe Abernathy had become one of my best friends, possibly the only person close to me who truly understand what I did and why." Unquote. Lisa T. writes, "Like Jamie and John, Claire and Joe bond over books, romance novels in particular. They are in the doctor's lounge and Claire picks up a coverless romance novel." Joe B. writes, "Once again, Diana has her tongue in her cheek with this brilliant example of the excesses of romance, of the romance genre, there being a difference between a romance novel and a romantic novel, as herself has addressed before. We see here the contrast between two women of romance genre often portrayed as powerless, overwhelmed, and vapid, in sharp comparison to most of the women in the world of Outlander. Trashy novels seem to be the gallows humor in Claire's hospital, and she is, in a wonderfully subversive twist, introduced to them by a man." Joe Abernathy and Claire develop a friendship from their both being outsiders, the only black intern and the only woman. Claire finds understanding with another who is different. Both Claire and Joe, like Jamie, create personas to cope with the stresses of their roles and circumstances. Claire uses her experience of wars and her interactions in the past to project confidence, and Joe uses Walter Cronkite to engender respect and acceptance. This way they face the changes of the 60s, the rise of civil rights and feminism, and our representation of these movements. Anne S. writes, "Claire loves romance novels. Is this a nod to Outlander's origins?" And Diana gives us the sly, impetuous pirate. Although it seems a distinct or even implied degree of consent is missing in this story, I am not a romance novel fan. Is this typical? I always thought this trope was a way for young girls being told an absolute no to sex as a way to enjoy it anyway without being accountable. She gives us a big sample of the story, even memorized page numbers and references. Who would do that in real life, really? Haha, we all do it, and this was a sweet nod to that. Regarding Joe, I like that she has a kindred spirit as a friend. And of course, since he is male, everyone will assume they are having an affair. That is the only reason men and women hang out together, right? But his role in her life is so tiny, I was a bit surprised they even cast him. Maybe we will see more in the TV show. At least she gets a new nickname, LJ. I wonder why Diana picked that one. So regarding the casting of Joe. Well, Anne, I'm not sure how far you have read. But that's all I can say. Joe's important. Right, Sam?
I mean,
crucial.
This isn't the end of Joe.
That's probably about, Joe's important. We'll say what we said and that's all. And we both are right. Eileen P. writes, there's an interesting parallel between Jamie and Claire in their reading material during their separation. In chapter 15, we found Jamie engrossed in an 18th century romance novel / bodice ripper. Now we learn that Claire, too, is drawn to that genre. For Claire, romance novels are a way to escape. Herself draws further attention to Jamie's rape of Geneva by giving a romance novel, escapist fantasy, version of rape from The Impetuous Pirate, the romance novel Claire is reading when she first bonds with Joe Abernethy. Let's see what happens when we do a wee 18th century bodice ripper, impetuous pirate, Voyager mashup. I like how Claire and Joe bond over a shared lack of support for them becoming doctors. Not only lack of support, but by society, but by their closest family members, Claire's husband Frank and Joe's mother. Quote, yeah, folks still think it's fine to say to your face that you can't be doing what you're doing, unquote. Looking back on their relationship, Claire concludes that Joe became one of her best friends. So while Claire is on the plane, after she reminisces about Joe and beginnings of their friendship, Claire doesn't want to escape just now. Diana writes, quote, outside, a floor of moonlit cloud cut us off from the earth below. Up here, everything was silent, beautiful and serene, in marked contrast to the turmoil of life below, unquote. Then we are given another time travel metaphor, quote, I had the odd feeling of being suspended, motionless, cocooned in solitude. At the same time, I knew we were rushing on, inexorably through the air, propelled at hundreds of miles per hour to some end. As for it being a safe one, we could only hope. Unquote. Compare this with Diana's description of her traveling through the stones. Definitely not serene, but at least in comparison with the car accident metaphor, quote, being suspended and motionless, unquote, and rushing towards something really fast to some end and not knowing where or how it would end. As long as she's on the plane, life is suspended. In Scotland, Roger and Bree are looking for Jamie. In Boston, lay her job. And Joe. She tried not to think about Jamie. Yet. The chapter ends, quote, I felt a slight ruffling of my hair, and one lock brushed against my cheek, light as a lover's touch. But surely it was no more than the rush of air from the vent overhead, and my imagination that the stale smells of perfume and cigarettes were suddenly underlaid by the scents of wool and heather. Unquote. What a beautiful chapter. Like, Diana, you didn't have to do that at the end. you always got to bring it in and like put the tear in there. Oh my gosh, woman. What a beautiful chapter. So we're introduced to Joe, given their similar backgrounds, at least as far as their uniqueness in med school goes, and the beginnings of their friendship. And the entire time you're on a plane, it's like life is in suspended animation. Have you ever felt that, some like kind of like, okay, I have a little time. I mean, I'm usually spending the time trying to sleep if I can, but
you're on your phone.
Well, only if there's Wi-Fi, otherwise there's no point. You know, it's kind of like outside of time. I mean, yeah, you may be thinking or worrying about things at home or be thinking about things to come, like if you're on vacation or wherever you're going, if you have to worry about those things. But it's still kind of outside of time because for the most part, unless you have Wi-Fi, you really can't. And even with Wi-Fi, you're kind of limited to what you could do. You may have communication ability, but you can't physically do much, right? Because you're stuck. You're in this can flying in the air. And not only does Diana describe her time on the plane as such, but at the end, when she thinks of Jamie and the impending decision she has to make, she thinks she smells the smells of him and his time. If you go along with air travel being likened to time travel, this travel that is out of time, travel in between places and times, then it would make perfect sense that Jamie, at least in some mode, is reaching out to her, or that she is able to feel close to or inspired by him or his country.
What did you think about that? The Jamie passage there.
The Jamie passage or the comments?
That was all me.
Oh, that was you? Then I'm making fun of you in my head.
You can make fun of me. I'm asking, what do you think about Jamie? I mean, not Jamie, the character. I mean, the little brush of Jamie at the end.
Well, first I thought to myself, does she have a glass of water around her? Is she summoning him? Is she?
Oh, Lord. Took me a second. Yeah. No.
But then you were like, well, maybe this is like, you know, like travel and this is a way he can reach out. And I was like, so you're saying that all ghosts reach out when you're on the plane because it's the perfect opportunity?
No. But she's in that other, like when Diana describes her. When she's traveling through time or traveling through the stones, she even unknowingly, one of the things we learn, I don't know if we've learned it yet, but having someone or thinking of someone or something in that time and location can help anchor you, right? Or can help steer you and help keep you safe, quite frankly. So you're not veering off into more unknown stuff. And she's obviously not time traveling, quote unquote, like for real through the stones right now. But there's that, which Diana tells us about. There is the, I think it was in Voyager at the very, very beginning, although it could have been DIA, where she talks about as a child she would avoid puddles because she would think that she would fall. And there was one time when she thought something about going through them or something about stars, that the only time she would walk through them, I guess, when there were stars, because she felt she'd be able to be safe because she could hang on to them. And someone, I think it was Lisa T, someone brought up during that imagery or during that the metaphor of that Jamie as the sun, the sun's a star. And so what would save her as she traveled would be Jamie or thoughts of Jamie. So now with this plane as time travel metaphor, thoughts of Jamie come and save her, and she can rest in them. That's what I was going for.
Only she can't rest because she's in a plane.
Exactly. She's in a can. And Anne S. writes, it's nice to know Jamie finally got up in a real plane after all and sees God's own view of the world. I would take wool and heather over perfume and cigarettes any day.
Like, cigarettes? They don't smoke on planes.
In the 60s, they did. Oh. In the 80s, they did, girl. What are you talking about?
Why don't I remember that? Like, I know they did.
Thankfully, we don't remember that.
I know they did. I don't think anyone ever did around me.
Well, we didn't fly that much in the 80s.
Okay.
We weren't negative. We were positive, but we didn't fly a lot. Okay. Amy D. writes, so often in this series, I find myself completely wrapped up in Jamie. His character, his struggles, his loves, his losses. But here, I am absolutely fascinated by Claire and the position she finds herself in. As a mother myself, I understand that complete and total determination to protect your child, that knowledge that you would do anything, sacrifice anything, in order for your child to live. So as gut-wrenching as it was, I totally get Claire leaving Jamie, going back to the stones, and raising Brianna in a much safer environment. But here in chapter 18, we see Claire wrestling with the knowledge that Jamie survived Culloden and may well still be alive 200 years in the past. The end of the chapter in particular truly breaks my heart. Claire thinks to herself, quote, back in Scotland, Roger and Bree were hunting Jamie, ahead in Boston, my job, and Joe were waiting. And Jamie himself? I tried to push the thought away, determined not to think of him until the decision was made, unquote. I wonder how often she'd had this same talk with herself, to push thoughts of Jamie away just so she could function. I mean, I think at least for 20 years. How often had Jamie been in Claire's thoughts? A welcome, beautiful memory, and yet one she had no choice but to shove away from her so she could survive the present. And immediately following the thought of Jamie in chapter 18, she's reminded of him by a, quote, slight ruffling of her hair, light as a lover's touch, and I'm reminded of his promise at the end of DIA to find her, even if he must endure 200 years of purgatory. And damn you, Amy, you almost made me cry.
I mean, it's been like 220 years of purgatory, right?
I thought you were going to say it's been like 2 minutes, Ginger. Why did it surprise you haven't cried again?
No.
Sorry, I'm thinking about tears. You're thinking about Jamie. Yeah. Yes, I think you're right. Pretty much. Well, as soon as she stepped through the stones, it was 200 years. Eileen P. writes, at the end of chapter 18, Claire has what might be a connection with Jamie through time. Is it his spirit or maybe a dream connection while Jamie sleeps? It's not clear how the connection is made. However, we feel Jamie watching over Claire as a possible reunion becomes more imminent. He is there reassuring her that he is waiting for her. She can feel his touch, smell his scent. Dude, I'm not going to make it through the freaking comments. What up, you guys? We haven't even gone to the next chapter, which is also sad. Joe B. writes, Claire's plane journey is forcing her to be inactive. She describes herself as cocooned, in suspended animation, inexorably propelled. She is being forced to reflection in contrast to the activity of Brian Roger hunting Jamie. An appropriate description for him. Intention far different, but Jamie is still a hunted man. No truly final decision can be made, and so Claire tries to limit her thoughts to practicalities, and it doesn't work. Try as she might to keep Jamie away, he comes to her anyway. Scent is strongly linked to memory. The association between her memories and familiar scents is physiologically possible. Romantically, I wonder what Jamie is doing. It would be September 1766, and we know how he dreams. Is this metaphysical re-entry of Jamie to some action in the story a foreshadowing that he is alive? Either way...
Oh, good Lord.
Stop it. Either way, it's so beautifully written that on my next long-haul flight, I shall pretend air vents are sending me some Jamie. Sorry. Made me go from tears to laughter. That was awesome. Okay.
That only works if you're not sitting next to a flatulent male.
Or Ginger.
Or you. Are you flatulent?
No, I was just going to say, or me, because I'm always talking to you.
your hopes of Heather and whatever, Heather and Wool.
Might be compromised if you sit next to me.
No.
Oh.
You are not a scent that is compromisable.
No, but the scent. No, it's not. Okay.
So you're saying that if you speak to me loud enough and long enough that I will no longer be able to smell?
I would distract you that you couldn't concentrate on the wonderfulness that is Jamie.
I'm just saying, if it was a scent that is familiar to me, no amount of talking on your end would stop the scent from being in my nose. I would still smell it. I might not, you know.
Be able to enjoy it as much.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're definitely going to ruin it, but I mean, it's not going to not exist. You can't replace a sound with a smell.
Martina P. writes, I do love the introduction of Joe Abernathy in this chapter. Claire and Joe feel drawn to each other because they are both minorities in their professional field in the 60s. They bond during discussions of the novel The Impetuous Pirate. I don't know if Diana is actually poking fun at trashy romance, or is she attempting to make Claire more grounded to the reader, that a woman of her caliber would actually spend her precious time indulging in trivial literature? It is also parallel to chapter 15 when Jamie was reading a romance novel of the kind.
So, a guy I knew was listening to this book.
Wait. Oh, the book, not us. Okay.
He's listening to the audiobook. And... almost stopped listening to the book full stop when he had to listen to them describing the romance novel.
Are you kidding me?
No.
Because the passages are so long.
Yes. And he was like, oh my God. Yeah. They were apparently very hard to listen to for a non-romance novel reader.
I'm not going to lie. I went, because I read it before, but this time prepping for this, I fast forwarded. I skimmed it really quickly.
Okay. And that was chapter 18 entitled Roots. Now we will move on to chapter 19 entitled To Lay a Ghost, which has so many meanings.
Yes.
Pick one.
I'll just read my notes.
Okay.
Eileen P. writes, to lay a ghost can mean to finally stop being worried or upset by something or someone that has worried or upset you for a long time. The title could also be referring to Claire's relationship with Frank. It could also mean that Claire is completing her grieving of Frank's death. Maybe it's laying the ghost of Jamie to rest as she learns he is not a ghost and there is prospect of them being reunited.
Of her laying him in real life.
But that's not a ghost.
He'd be flesh.
Or is she thinking about laying him and he's currently a ghost?
Lisa T writes, the title to lay a ghost figuratively means to put to rest someone or something that has upset one. In this chapter, we see Claire return home to Boston, where she puts to rest the ghosts of her 20 past years so that she can return to Jamie. Claire arrives at her Fury Street, Boston, Massachusetts home, where she had lived with Frank and Bree for almost 20 years. She comes home to wilted azaleas and giving them a little water kind of speaks to them a little bit like, I'm going to do this and that's it. I got stuff to do. It's inside. Maybe enough water, maybe not. And of course, it's a plant. So I looked it up.
Oh, Lord.
Oh, Lord. I know. Okay. According to flowermeaning.com, the following things are possibilities for azaleas. They can stand for remembering your home with fondness or wishing to return to it. I don't know if that's apropos here. Taking care of yourself and your family. I think that you could say passion that is still developing and fragile. Elegance and wealth. Femininity and feminine beauty. Abundance, especially of beauty or intelligence. I don't know. Azaleas are deciduous and considered by British gardeners as a, quote, reserved and self-managed addition, unquote. So since Claire and Frank were British, were English, then maybe. It was often sent, the azaleas are often sent as a gift when one person urged another to reconsider their feelings or hold back from making a public display of affection. Since the blooms can fall off the shrub when brushed by a passing person or a strong breeze, there is a connection to fragile or developing love that could still fail to blossom. That, I think, is a little bit telling. And according to flowerinfo.org, azaleas are a flowering shrub that grow their best during damp portions of the spring season. These flowers are known for releasing a sweet scent and having bright, cheerful colors. Joe B. writes, the house is not home for Claire, and the azaleas are perhaps a metaphor for her. She too is in a place she doesn't like, but has stayed for Bree. They are waiting, like Claire, for rejuvenation. Their change back to a brighter life through the water. Claire waiting for her chance to be a fuller, truer version of herself as the possibility of Jamie grows. The azaleas are next to a door for added symbolism, and it must be Claire's choice to walk through it to find that other self. So Claire gets in, and she goes to take a bath. And she is testing herself ever since she'd boarded the plane in Scotland for home. And she had been, quote, taking careful note of the machines, all the conveniences of modern daily life, and more important, her own response to them. She asked herself, did she really care? She had done this before, lived without all of these conveniences, but the difference was now, I mean, she had during the war, of course, too, but I'm specifically speaking about when she slipped back through to the 18th century. The difference was now she could choose. She didn't have a choice before. Now, if they were meaningful enough to her, she could choose to not give them up. She gives evidence as her time with Uncle Lamb in conditions that could be called primitive. So she knows that not only has she lived in her upbringing with Uncle Lamb during the war, relatively primitive, and during when she was 18th century Scotland. So she knows darn well that she does not need these things. And as she's prepping the bath, she describes, or is described for us, 18th century hip baths, wherein one would typically immerse the center of the body first. And at first I was like, how do you do that? And then she explained, you basically sit in water and drape your legs over the edge, right? So you basically your booty, your hips, your booty and your middle bits are cleaned or are immersed. And then you stand, rinse your upper torso while soaking the feet. I've definitely never done that. Have you ever had a hip bath, Sam?
No, I don't think so.
There were conveniences and there were modern dangers as well. So world wars and, quote, civilized warfare were, she considered, worse even than their earlier versions. The real issue for her was the people involved. Her, Brianna, and Jamie. Anne S. writes, Claire comes home to the house she has clearly already let go of, and the process begins. I laugh as she thinks of all the modern things she is used to, and could she live without them? I have also wondered if I lived at a different time. Suddenly, how would I fare? Then I remember I read this chapter while getting a delicious massage in my hot tub, checking my phone for news updates, and haven't slept outside since I was 12. So, nope, 18th century life would wreck me. Yeah. I love our listeners. Summer's like, me too. Or would you go back to Jamie?
I mean, I definitely go.
You might complain, but you definitely would go. If you complain too much, you might be burned as a witch. So you gotta be careful. Eileen P. writes, it is wonderful to learn Claire is testing her need for modern conveniences. It is further anticipation of a possible Jamie and Claire reunion. As she asks herself if she could live without these, I'll just read it. Quote, could I live without all the conveniences, large and small, to which I was accustomed? I had been asking myself that with each touch of a button, each rumble of a motor, and was quite sure that the answer was yes. And with that yes, Claire moves another step closer to Jamie. After she climbs out of the tub, she gives herself a thorough inspection in the mirror. This is the best description we get of a 50-year-old Claire. No bagging is in her arms. The muscles of her upper arms are nicely defined. Her shoulders are nicely defined. They're rounded and sloping to the high curve of her pectoralis major. Her abdominals are fine. Her rectus abdominis, almost concave, Diana writes. Her back looked good. She had a narrow waist, and her backside had no dimples. Quote, it could be a lot worse, she said to her backside.
I always talk to my backside.
Oh, gosh. Maybe I need to talk to mine. Lisa T. writes, this reminded me of Jamie looking at his reflection for the first time in years and realizing his resemblance to Willie. Amy D. writes, I love that in this chapter, Claire thinks of all the ways her life prepared her to live without modern conveniences. Because, I mean, let's be honest, hot baths, flushing toilets, and air conditioning are all things many of us, me included, would have a tough time living without. But Claire grew up with her Uncle Lam in primitive conditions, and additionally, her time as a combat nurse during World War II gave her yet another opportunity to live without the conveniences people of the 40s were accustomed to. She even says she never found the lack of them acute. It's as if the universe had been preparing her from the time she was a very little girl for the choice she would make at this juncture of her life. In chapter 19, Claire is every woman as she worries about her appearance, as she considers Jamie seeing her for the first time in 20 years. She says she's glad, quote, the family doesn't run to fat, and thinks to herself as she looks at her backside that there are no dimples anyway. Claire is most often so very confident and assured, and this touch of insecurity is endearing. It makes her so believable because every woman can relate to those feelings. I'm so glad Diana wrote this part and gave us all a part of Claire we could claim to understand. Joe B. writes, once inside, Claire reverts to type. She has begun an internal search in preparation for possible return to the past, examining her life now with what it has been. In the prologue, she describes herself as a mucky child, used to living without the conveniences of the times. It pays off again here. The most formative times of her life have been without them. Childhood on archaeological digs, a warfield hospital, and her time with Jamie. It is ironic that much of her time in the past was easier than her earlier life in the 20th century. Having found modern lifestyle wanting, she takes a physical inventory and seems to reach a positive conclusion. Eileen P. writes, then Claire assesses her body. It is 20 years since being with Jamie, so of course her body has changed, and Claire wants to see how much. All in all, she has aged well. Her assessment is, it could be a lot worse. And now she feels comfortable with her body, which is another step closer to Jamie. Claire goes through the nightly routine of prepping the house for the night. Diana describes Brianna's habit of collecting things and finding just the right spot for them. And it's odd, she thinks, because it was one of Frank's attributes. Brianna likes the colors. I don't know why I wrote this down. I just found this. It may not be important. I found it striking, though. Brianna likes the colors turquoise, indigo, magenta, and yellow. Those are bright, bold colors. So
I think make an interesting tartan.
Interesting is a nice way to put it. Claire doesn't have a way with objects, Diana tells us. Bri and Frank do. Claire lived, quote, mostly inside her skin, with no impulse to alter her surroundings to reflect herself. And she thinks perhaps it's due to her nomadic upbringing. Jamie was also a person who carried only the bare necessities with him. Jamie, too, had lived as a wanted man, had gone to war, quote, one of the things that made us seek completion in each other. And by that, I mean, even though they had different upbringings, Jamie also had enough of a time on the road, on the lamb, Uncle Lamb on the lamb, even, at, you know, in war, when he wasn't running for his life, he was fighting in France. So Jamie knows also what it's like to not have the most comfortable life of what he's used to when he was growing up at Lallybroch. Eileen P. writes, we learn that Brianna and Frank have a way with objects, being able to place things so that they not only have meaning in their own right, but represent their owner. It sounds like an archaeologist or historian would be able to look at Brianna's bedroom or Frank's office and be able to develop a thorough idea of its owner. Whereas Claire does not have this knack with objects, nor a need to acquire them. Thus, she is not hindered by material objects. She is able to travel light. Perhaps this is another test, one to see if she needs material things. We learn that Claire lives within her own skin and has no impulse to alter her surroundings. Perhaps this is one reason Claire adapts so well to her environment, whether she's in the 20th century or in the 18th century. She is also a good time traveler because she doesn't have the need to alter her surroundings and so will not dramatically alter the future by her presence. When Claire enters the bedroom, she thinks of Frank. It is where she said her final goodbye to him. Joe B. writes, facing the bed means facing Frank. We get a glimpse of two people who are aware of each other but not emotionally engaged. Clearly unable to understand who Claire is, she makes concessions for him, but can't be the homemaker he wants her to be. Bri takes on this role as nurture wins over nature. Claire remarks that Bri resembles both her parents. She looks like Jamie and has traits of Frank. Bri is a collector and arranger of things, but they are what is left of Bri in the house. However, she doesn't live there anymore. Claire relives a scene of when they're in bed. Frank is thinking about his upcoming sabbatical. He wants to take Bri with him. She's almost graduated, and he says he's going now for good without Claire. Lisa T. writes, I've always wondered what Frank's true motivation was. Did he find Claire in the past and was he trying to protect Bri? Or was he just having an affair? Maybe all, but pulling a child out of school halfway through her senior year is quite radical. Frank adored Bri and always wanted what was best for her. So for him to suggest something so drastic makes me question his true motives. Also, if Frank can get Claire to think it is just an affair, he wouldn't have to give her the truth. Not out of punishment, but for her own sake and Bri's. That is very interesting. That's the first time I've ever considered him allowing, because there was definitely female interest and I'm sure he had interest back. But if we go with Diana for a moment and say that, you know, Frank did not have an affair, it's interesting that he didn't put up too much of a fight here and that might be a reason, Lisa T. Summer, have you ever considered that?
Which part?
The fact that he might have gone along with the idea or not denied an affair
because he found her in the past
or he was whatever, he was trying to protect her from the real reason he was doing this.
I honestly can never ever see past the fact that he is basically her adopted father and trying to rip her from her biological mother. That pisses me off. It will always piss me off. And I don't care. I mean, part of me cares, but most of me doesn't care the reason behind it. I think that it's not his right. And I don't know how he could explain that to me in a way that would make this whole scene okay with me.
And I think that is actually the strongest evidence as to why this, I that's what Lisa is saying, that this is so drastic and so exactly what you just said, that for it to be what he's saying on the surface is almost unforgivable and completely incomprehensible. And that's, I think, what Lisa is saying, that there must, or she would not be surprised if there were something else going on that he is either not ready or able or willing to tell her for some reason. And he's allowing the whole affair thing to, he's not denying it, like straight up denying it, but he's allowing her to think that he's up and wants to up and move with Bree, get her into school. He's got a nice job and he's got a nice mistress, and allow her to go with that because that's easier for him than admitting whatever this truth is. I think that's an interesting possibility.
But whatever this quote unquote truth is, taking Bree into the middle of whatever this is, if it's not an affair, doesn't seem safe either.
Well, I don't want to get too far ahead. I think I know where you may be heading, and I want to go there, but we can't. But I see what you're saying. Unless the danger he sees is that she stays with Claire, which is odd, or the reason. You know what I'm saying? So we can't say too much more without getting like seven books or six books ahead. But this is so fascinating, and not just that this happens now, but that it happens the night that he dies. And there's even so much. We got to release that. Yeah, we're gonna have to release that. We're going to have to release our Moby ep because I think we talk about this. So I could be wrong, but we can add this to some speculation to Moby. But there's so much that this is the kind of thing I guess we could do, you know, in a private chat somehow, somewhere, without talking about the books, talk about possibilities that tangent off from early books like Voyager.
And also, Diana keeps going on and on and on and on and on about how she says Frank didn't have an affair. And it's really hard for me to read her saying that when Claire states,
doesn't deny it. Yeah.
Not only that, but Claire states that over the years, several of his quote unquote mistresses have come up to her and begged her to let him go.
Yes, but all we know from her is that they've said to let him go. They haven't said, I'm sleeping with your husband, let him go. So that doesn't mean that they didn't say it to her, but Claire's not sharing that with us. So I'm trying to stay kind of on, I am not judging anyone who chooses to take a side on this. I think there's evidence. I think there are two sides. I mean, that's what everyone can say. And I have a hard time taking sides because you have the author who is the creator of this whole thing, but you have this really strong, I mean, you know, this chapter is like pretty hard. It's hard to swallow, you know?
Well, this is the chapter that everybody remembers when they say Frank is a cheater.
Yeah. And, let's get to that.
There has to be, maybe it's book 9, maybe it's book 10, where there's an entire section of the book where she comes clean. Or something, you know, they find out about Frank and what Frank knew.
She's writing a book about what
Frank
knew.
I know, but hopefully that, you know, we'll know what Frank knew before he died.
Oh my God. Well, it's too late. He already died. We're not going to know it. We're going to know it after he died. That's the truth. But yeah, that to me, I think that book is going to be more interesting than the prequel, more interesting than any bulge, and more interesting.
There's nothing more interesting than a bulge. What?
More interesting than any bulge, more interesting than Hal and Minnie, the garden thing coming up. Okay, back to the chapter. Claire immediately suspects the fact that he wants to take her away and leave and all of this and go set up house overseas. She immediately suspects it's an affair. His reaction isn't very encouraging. Quote, the look of alarm that flashed into his eyes was so pronounced as to be comical, unquote. Now that, I had a hard time. I was like, hot dang, I didn't remember he reacted like that. Good grief. And then he said, quote, I thought I had been most discreet, unquote. Now, either he's feeding into it, again, along the lines, like Lisa's saying, allowing her, like, okay, if we go with Lisa's thought, just for a moment, the look of alarm, right, could be, holy F, she thinks I'm doing this? Okay, let's go with it. To cause, remember, he was a spy. Homeboy, once a spy, always a spy, right? Once a spook, always a spook. He always retains that ability to get what he wants or manipulate, whatever, get information, or to distract, deflect. So maybe the look of alarm was like, what? You went there? Are you kidding me? And then he's like, oh, okay, let's go with that. Let's deflect. Yes, I thought I was discreet. You know, I'm just saying, if that is it, if that's a possibility, then that's the only way I could line those two things up. Because otherwise, him being shocked, like, at being discovered or whatever, it's quite a guilty look.
Yeah.
It's interesting. This is going back to what we're talking about. Diana says that Frank did not cheat. Now, it's not hard for me to say this. It's so polarizing, this whole thing. My heart wants to tend to believe her because she wrote this material. However, it seems that Frank is guilty of something. Why else the need for discretion? Again, unless it's to deflect. What do you think? I mean, I know your thoughts on him having an affair, but what do you think about Frank, whether it's an affair or not, Frank feeling or being guilty of something? If it's not an affair, what the heck?
Well, I mean, if he is still rogue MI6 or MI5 or whatever MI, blah, 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 if he's still doing his spy stuff from the war, then it could be deflection, and these women could have all been covers over the years, but what a strange cover.
I mean, I'm not saying he's continuing to work for a government. I'm saying once you're a spy, always a spy, in that you're always suspicious. You're always looking around, behind, underneath. You're looking for deeper meaning of things, right? You're trying to, and then even if you don't necessarily suspect someone of something, although you probably are able to read someone better or in a different way, you have training in that, right? And then if you, see, he was already a historian. He was already a trained historian. He already looked for clues and did research and wrote scholarly papers about things that he found. You put that together with someone who's trained as a spy, he doesn't have to be suspicious of a person or a thing. He already has the work, his life's work after the war, after Claire got back, his life's work was this. He was already into the Jacobite thing, right? That becomes his life work once Claire is back. So even as quote unquote, just a historian trying to do this research into the past, maybe into Jamie's past. Who knows? We don't know anything yet about how or what or why or however he's going, but he certainly would have a vested interest, right? If his wife is claiming something, that would make sense that he would actually at least want to look into something, and he's already interested in the period, so why not? So even if he's not working for any government or doing anything, you know, spy-ish, the fact that he's a historian, he's already investigative by nature. By his job, he's paid to investigate things, to look and to find things out. Add to that spy training. All I'm saying is it could be an affair. It doesn't have to be an affair. But I'm curious, if it's not an affair, what the heck? You know what I mean?
We may never know.
Or we may have to wait till we get the book. Well, even in the book, we may never know because whatever. Okay. Frank won't respond regarding the other woman. He says that Bree can go to boarding school for her final semester. Claire has a gut reaction to the mere thought of sending Bree to boarding school. She had nearly been left to that fate when her uncle inherited her before he agreed to take her along with him. Frank has been offered a position at Cambridge and means to leave the U.S. permanently. Claire is shocked. She thinks he's planned this for quite a while. A new job, to take Bree, set up house, and having a new mistress. She won't have him taking Bree. He condescends to tell her that she can visit anytime she wants, and he calls her my daughter. Frank maintains that with Claire at the hospital so much, Bree won't have anyone to take care of her. Claire maintains that she's almost grown. Frank thinks that it's a critical time, especially as university is coming up. He's up close and personal with a lot of the things that young students do or are doing. And so was Claire, she says. But then Frank goes somewhere else. Quote,
better swaddled than an effing black man. And then, quote, like mother, like daughter, eh? But that's not how it's going to be, damn it. Not if I've anything to say about it, unquote. I wrote, wow. So Frank thinks she's having an affair with Joe? In his words, it would appear so. But again, I am curious, once Claire made that accusation and we see the shock on his face or the alarm on his face, and he goes, now Lisa has got me thinking about this in a different way, a possible way, is that now maybe he's trying to add fuel to the fire. I don't know. I really don't know. He's trying to add fuel to the fire to, this is obviously not going to make it easy for him to take Brianna, but I don't even know. I'm all kinds of jumbled inside now. Frank says that everyone thinks she's sleeping with Joe. It seems Frank is a little bit country. If by country, you mean racist. Lisa T writes, again, not sure if he's deflecting or if he really thinks that Claire is sleeping with Joe. Either way, it's a very low moment for Frank. See, Lisa, I didn't even read that yet. Lisa went where I went. But to be fair, it is not just African-Americans he doesn't want Bree hanging around. It's people with tattoos, lounge lizards, and please, no marches or rallies or orgies and low dives.
So all the fun people.
All the fun people with piercings. He's worried about Bree marrying a Muslim. In the end, they are at an impasse. She says he will not take her, and he says he doesn't need her permission to take his daughter. Lisa T. writes, this next bit reminds me of the custody battle for Willie. Claire says, you can divorce me and use any grounds but adultery. But she threatens to expose his adultery if he tries to take away Bree from her. She says, quote, do you want to know how many of your discarded mistresses have come to see me to ask me to give you up? Unquote. Now, technically, this isn't proof of adultery, but it's awfully damaging. And she said she'd give him up in a heartbeat if he'd asked. She supposes he never did because of Bree. Now, is this a little bit of foreshadowing? Quote, his face had gone quite bloodless now and showed white as a skull in the dimness on the other side of the bed, unquote. He says, quote, I shouldn't have thought you minded. It's not as though you ever made a move to stop me, unquote. And then he says something quite moving. You might have behaved as though it mattered to you. She said it did. And he said, not enough. And then they get to Jamietown talk. Frank knows that Brianna looks like Jamie. He could tell she thought of Jamie whenever she looked at Bree. He damns her glass face for allowing him to see all of her feelings. She reminds him she tried to tell him to leave her when she first got back, but he wouldn't listen. He says he couldn't leave Claire because she was pregnant, and then once the baby was there, he couldn't leave Bree. Now, in the book series, now is when we find out that he knows he's sterile. Of course, in the TV series, they brought that up to the end of season 2. Yeah. Claire says that even without Bree around, as a constant reminder, she wouldn't have been able to stop thinking of Jamie. And this is what sends Frank over the edge. And he gets dressed and leaves the house and drives away. Lisa T. writes, again, I am reminded of Willie's situation. His supposed father was sterile or unable, as Frank is, and he claims Willie is his child. At least Geneva gave him a son. Joe B. writes, Claire and Frank's last night is a culmination of many years of things unsaid. Frank wants to return to England, taking Bree but leaving Claire. She asks, quote, strangely composed, if this latest mistress is putting pressure on him. This story is from Claire's perspective true, but here is undenied proof that Frank has been unfaithful. I'm not sure I can entirely blame him. His disconnection from Claire, both physically and emotionally, has left him to seek his varied needs elsewhere. Bree is his reason to stay. Why he wants to go now is worth the question. Has he reached a breaking point, or, as the text seems to infer, does he have a new life planned? I don't think it's the infidelity Claire objects to. She doesn't have much of a leg to stand on here. It's his disingenuousness She would have given him the divorce. Indeed, she offered that 20 years ago, but he never asked. Claire is adept at finding her place in stressful situations, so living with Frank's infidelity is just part of that. I also think there is a risk of seeing Claire as the wronged party here. I don't think that's so. She has long known and for many reasons chosen to stay in the marriage, and I think that she wasn't unfaithful to Frank this time around for any noble reasons of the sanctity of marriage. The person that she, quote, reached for in the night, unquote, wasn't there. I think if someone could have truly taken Jamie's place, she would have gone there. Frank displays some of the snobbery and racism of the time and of his Englishness better be unhappy than challenging his idea of social conventions. What sets the composed Claire off is when Frank tells her what he's going to do with his daughter, and he will do what he says. Firstly, she's not actually his daughter despite any legal status. Secondly, it's a bad decision that actually isn't about Bree at all. It's about his desire for the life he wants. Thirdly, nothing gets Claire's back up more than being told what to do. She plays the infidelity card. Have your divorce, fine, but take Bree, and then she'll talk infidelity. Eileen P. writes, yes, he cheated. Did Claire give him reason to cheat? Yes. Although she tried, Claire could not let go of Jamie. Frank did try to be discreet about his affairs, but Claire knew. This was not a happy marriage. I find it rather possessive of Frank to take Brianna away from Claire and keep her with him. It's selfish of him to take a teenage daughter, who is in her last year of high school, away from her mother, her friends, her school, and her home, so that he can stick her in a boarding school near him in England. It's a way of abusing Claire. It's not just trying to keep the daughter that he loves with all his heart. He's trying to take away Claire's reminder of Jamie. I love the line, quote, I vaguely noticed the chill in the room, but was so angry that I felt hot all over, unquote. Yes, the room was already cold in the beginning of the scene, but when I read about it in the context of Frank trying to take Brianna away from Claire, that chill in the room feels like Jamie's anger. Jamie sent Claire back through the stone so that she and his child, Brianna, would survive. He was entrusting their care to Frank. With that chill, I feel Jamie's presence, and he is not happy. Frank didn't come back. The hospital hadn't called. She gets up and goes to the hospital. Black ice on the roads. It was 4 a.m. She goes about her job, sees her patients, and then ends up in the cafeteria wondering what she'll tell Bree about what Frank had said. Someone brings her the news. There was something about snow on black ice and a DOA and identification in a wallet. Frank is dead before her on a hospital gurney. She says, Frank, if you're still close enough to hear me, I did love you. Once I did, unquote. And then Joe was there, calls her Claire for the first time. She rests against him and for the first time weeps for Frank. Back in the house on Fury Street, after Claire has arrived from Scotland, she wept for Frank again, remembering her last goodbye. Quote, now I wept for him for the last time.
Hold it together. You got this.
Knowing even as the tears slid down my cheeks that we had parted once and for all, 20 odd years before, on the crest of a green Scottish hill. Goodbye, my dear, she whispered. And went out to sleep downstairs, away from the ghosts.
This just got real sad. And kind of awkward. You gonna blow your nose or?
No, I'm good. Lisa T. writes, Claire recalls more of that night. Quote, the streets were slick as butter, black ice gleaming in the streetlights. The yellow phosphor glow lit whorls of falling snow. Within an hour, the ice that lined the streets would be concealed beneath fresh powder and twice as perilous to travel. The only consolation was that there was no one on the streets at 4 a.m. to be imperiled. No one but me, that is. Inside the hospital, the usual warm, stuffy institutional smell wrapped itself around me like a blanket of familiarity, shutting out the snow-filled black night outside. Unquote. This reminds me, Lisa writes, of Jamie being warm and safe in the stables at Hellwater during the storm when Willie is born and Geneva dies. Both Claire and Jamie find warmth and refuge in their places of work. Jamie in the stables and Claire in the hospital. The next morning, the doorbell wakes her. It's a telegram. And this is all it says. It's hard to get this one out too.
Oh my God.
Is it not?
No, I'm fine.
Have found him. Stop. Will you come back? Query. Roger. Thus ends the in-between time for Claire. From here on out, it's on to make her decision. She has said her goodbye to Frank and his ghost. She now preps for forward movement. Amy D. writes, I thought that Claire's remembrance of Frank was a lovely tribute. Frank is a character I've never been overly attached to, so it's not like I'm actually missing him. But the fact is that Frank existed, and he was an important part of the story of Claire's life and especially Brianna's life. I found Claire's remembrance and her acceptance of the part both she and he played in the destruction of their relationship very poignant. I feel it was the closure she needed in order to make the next decision. Anne S. writes, Frank and Claire's last night. It never seems all that clear what kind of relationship that they settled into. Still comfortable enough to cuddle, but clearly full of 18-ish years of misunderstanding, disappointments, and resigned resentments. I always felt a bit sorry for Frank in this arrangement. Claire is not with him at all, emotionally or physically. She is either at the hospital or thinking about it. It is her true home. Who can blame him if he seeks affection somewhere else? Doesn't he also deserve love? I have heard that Diana defends Frank as not having actually cheated, that this is just Claire's assumption. But it is hard to read this passage and see that. When Frank says, quote, I thought I had been more discreet, unquote. Is that not an admission? There have even been visits from discarded women. Did he just toy with them? And he admits that he wanted her to stop him, to act as if he mattered. And then Claire's simple no, that she would have never forgotten Jamie, breaks my heart for Frank. And she says in parentheses, Anne does, I just read Diana's defense of Frank, and she mostly seems to refer to what he does during the war and 3 years she is gone. She doesn't address this information. Then, she says, Frank goes on a horrid tirade about kids drinking and drugging. That's what the kids call it, drugging. And then he goes all racist on us. Wow. How will the TV show handle this part of Frank? Will they tone it down a bit? I felt it was out of character for him. Does he really think it's a good idea to move Bree away before she leaves for college anyway? Or right before she leaves for college? And Frank became a really awful, selfish person here. I wonder how, if at all, the story would have changed if Frank just went to England instead of dying. And while she tells him she did love him once, I suspect he still isn't grateful for that little crumb. Eileen P. writes, interesting how Claire notes the perilous driving conditions, but thinks she's the only one on the road. Frank drove off shortly before she did, yet she doesn't even think about him. Really strange considering they were just arguing. Claire can be thoughtless when it comes to Frank. It just seemed automatic to not even consider him. However, when she hopes to speak to his ghost in the hospital post-fatal incident, she makes sure he knows that she did love him once. It is then that she weeps for him for the first time, having never really contemplated how much she hurt him during the course of their marriage. Back at the house, Claire admits that she and Frank had parted once and for all on the hills of Scotland. She weeps for Frank for the last time and lays that ghost to rest. And finally, Martina P. writes, the Claire flashbacks of Frank really don't do his character any favors. In fact, I think he was pretty awful. First of all, as a professor and historian, I did not expect Frank to be such a racist. I would have imagined him to be more open-minded than many other people of his time. He gets very low by accusing Claire of having an affair with Joe Abernathy. In my opinion, it is just a deflection of his own guilty conscience of having had repeated affairs. Claire calls him out on it and stated that she easily would have let him go if he had only asked. This statement tells me that Claire really did not care about his infidelity, and Frank so wanted her to care. There are, of course, a couple things in Frank's favor. First of all, his unconditional love of Brianna. Raising her, spending time, and taking good care of her so Claire was able to attend and finish medical school. Internship and residency followed, which means Brianna was mostly in Frank's care for many years. Also, I am sure Frank paid for her medical education. No small things, surely. Frank was a good provider and took care of his family. Was he a good husband? Probably not. So, Summer...
But did we, correct me if I'm wrong, did he not tell her to do it?
He did.
So another thing I have against Frank is...
To hold it against her once he told her
to hold it against her when he's the one who told her to do it.
Yep.
So I'm like, you can't say, go do this thing. You have to do this. I'll watch the baby. I'll figure the schedule out. I'll make it work. Mm-hmm. This is something you need. And then hold it against her 20 years later. That's just a dick move.
Yeah, it's
end of rant.
No, it's okay. Yeah, I think. Yeah. It's all, there's so many things to talk about in these two chapters, especially chapter 19. I mean, my goodness. So we look forward to what you guys think. We will definitely, we share this everywhere anyway, the links. But when we get the link up for the episode, we'll share the episode in the group like we normally do, but we'll also put it, because we want you to listen, obviously, but we don't want to talk too much about all the surrounding possibilities that Lisa and others have brought up. And then I went on for, 20 minutes on, that the place to do that would be, I'll make an extra post in the Voyager read-along event. And I really want your guys' feedback on that. I mean, you can obviously always get back to us on Twitter or Facebook, but especially in the group, it's a little more closed, and people, and you have to go out of your way to find the conversation. That way no one will be spoiled. But I honestly didn't think this was going to be a difficult chapter to go through. Admittedly, when I was taking notes, I got a little tear prick. That's fine. But I did not like bubble up like that. That is redonkulous.
It was.
You're like, I'm not gonna take anything away from that, Ginger. You're right.
I can't dispute that fact. I sat here silently waiting for you to pull it together.
Wow.
So join us next time when we will be discussing chapters 20 to 20. That's gonna sound confusing. 20 through 23, and that will finish part 5 and get us ready to go into part 6. So which gets us. Ever so much faster and not faster, but closer to Print Shop.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Print Shop is chapter 24 called
A Malcolm, comma, printer.
Yep.
Can't forget the comma. It's coming.
Do we have a visitor on that one? Or was I selfish and said no visitors?
I thought you said no one was allowed on that one.
Because it's a little
bit. You might have told me I couldn't come on that one.
I can't talk about it on my own. No, I mean, I can talk. I can't talk. I can talk, but I don't get to myself. Yeah. I guess I can do that too. So we still have some, visitors coming on, and we'll have at least one visitor in part 6 and visitors further down the road, or friends joining us along on the read along. And we're developing, bringing more on as we go. So I guess this was our last episode for 2016. What are you thinking?
I have so many feelings about 2016.
I was about to say, are you talking about the read-along or are you talking about 2016?
2016. Because part of me is like, oh my God, it flew by. I feel like it was just 2015, And then also, conversely, I need it to be over. I need this year to be over, especially just the last couple of days with all of the celebrity passings. It just has to be over. I need it to be over.
It's gone from, okay, that's really hard to call a coincidence. I mean, I'm not saying it's not a coincidence, but it's gone from celebrity deaths, I mean. It's gone from, like, shocking to sad to, oh my goodness, to, you know, disbelief to now. It's, like, on a roll, and it just hasn't stopped. And it's literally not letting up before the end of the year. And today we are recording this on the 29th. Good Lord, who knows? We still have two more days, and I'm a little bit afraid. So, just, yeah. So we are mixed about 2016. Is that a good way to put it?
I'm ready for it to be over.
100% ready for it to be. I'm ready for 2017. I'll put it that way. I had in many respects a wonderful 2016. I was able to travel probably more this year than I have ever. Not necessarily overseas, but, you know, just in how much I did. It was fun. I got to meet a lot of people. I went to new events. It was crazy busy and really, 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 really nice.
I feel like we just stumbled into a wrap-up of 2016 episode.
Kind of. But sorry. Anyway, so my point is there was positive in family, positive with friends, positive in travel, and so many things. Like, I have a hard time defending why 2016 was maybe not the best for me. I will say, for a number of reasons, the end of 2016 has not been easy. Just for me personally, I can't speak for anyone else, but it's been a rough autumn. I will say that. Autumn and early winter. Part of that is maybe the move and just weird. I don't know. Maybe it's different Mercury and retro. I have no idea. Just whatever. Celebrities, who knows? But what began and seemed to be, you know, a really rocking year, potentially could have been an awesome year, and was really nice in many respects, just kind of changed for me toward the end. It was a little harder. So I also look forward to 2017.
I don't have to do a rundown of things I did in 2016, right?
No.
Okay, it was just you. Okay, good. Okay.
It wasn't just me. It just happened. So as we wind down the show, before we get to all the ways that we can be contacted and thank our friends at Zencastr, we wanted to thank everyone who has become a supporter through Patreon. And if you haven't, we invite you to do so. One of the ways, there are many ways to support us. Obviously, you can follow us, you can chat with us, you can subscribe to the podcast, you can leave a review that helps people find us in iTunes. And there's so many ways. But one of the most direct ways, or actually I should say the newest way, is to support us through Patreon. And they have all kinds of levels. We've talked about this in a previous show. They have different levels that you can support us at in any way you like. You could even do your own level. I mean, we've got a few $2 coming through that we didn't set. So we have a number of you have selected to support us, and we're so thankful. And we just want to, again, share that URL. It is patreon.com/OutlanderPod. That is patreon.com/OutlanderPod. So with that, we wish you a very happy new year and a wonderful, wonderful 2017. Thank you as always so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/OUTLANDERPOD. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram.
Outlander Pod.